I have a daunting task this morning to talk about Ecclesiastes chapter 3. I'm sure that many of you have loved this chapter and meditate upon it many a time. There are a lot of ingredients I will not be able to share with you, but I hope that the message I'm going to deliver to you this morning will be expanded in your mind through your further meditation. The title I chose for today's message is Divine Paradox. This idea comes from chapter 3, verse 11, which says, "He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end." Merriam-Webster's English Dictionary defines the word paradox as, one such as a person, situation, or action having seemingly contradictory qualities or phases. Or, number two, a statement that is seemingly contradictory or opposed to common sense and yet is perhaps true. End of quote. Chapter 3, verse 11 truly includes elements fitting this particular definition, I think. See as follows. God has set the world. In King James Bible, the world is being translated by other major translations as eternity. So God has set the eternity in the human heart. Yet, on the other hand, no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. So even though we have such a capacity to long for eternity, God has put the limitation at the same time so that we cannot comprehend everything we desire to know about. I'm sure that in your private and personal life you have experienced so much on that particular aspect of God's divine work. The preacher explains that God has imposed the limitations on the human race that undermine their efforts to look beyond the present, especially to understand the past and probe into the future. Expressed differently, because people are creatures of time, their heavenly imposed finitude subverts their ability to fathom the eternal plan of God. So longing, the desire for eternity, the concept is there, but there is also limitations on human mind. God has placed within people an awareness of the timeless, namely a sense of duration, yet he also prevents people from understanding what he does in all the key undertaking of life. Man's efforts to look beyond the present, and there are imposed limitations upon him. And this is also, a part of it is caused by the effects of sin too. Because Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden were able to know the will of God and they were able to do the will of God. But after the fall, man's mind is darkened. C.L. Seow remarked that, in quote, "God is responsible for giving both time and eternity." When we are talking about time, we are talking about God's creation. Time itself is created. It has its own limits. And eternity does not have it. So God is responsible for giving both time and eternity, and the human being is caught in the tension between the two. Charles Bridge observed that people, in quote, "can neither unravel the thread of God's counsels nor grasp the infinite perfection of his work," end of quote. Walter Kaiser described the finitude and frustration of human beings in this way, in quote, "So vast, so eternal, and so comprehensive in its inclusion is God's plan that man is both threatened and exasperated in his attempts to discover it for himself." End of quote. So while man is trying to find the meaning of everything within his own capacity, he cannot find it, and at the end of it, he is exactly, as he says, threatened and exasperated and frustrated. Andy Williams maintains that God, in quote, "does not resolve the crisis for mankind. Instead, he remains hidden in his person, work, and justice," end of quote. That's why we do have a lot of questions in our life events. things to happen against our expectations, against our principles and understanding of even God's truth. In the light of this dilemma, E.P. Lee concluded that, in quote, any attempt to strain for the impossible or master the mysterious is destined to lead only to frustration and failure, end of quote. Probably some of you have tried it. Why this happened to me? Why that does not happen to me? The end, no answer to those questions at all. So only frustration comes upon us. John Polkinghorne stated in an interview that, in quote, the mysterious infinite reality of God cannot be caught within the finite nets of human thinking, end of quote. As Derek Kidner said, people, in quote, see enough to recognize something of its quality, yet the grand design eludes them, for they can never stand back far enough to view it as the Creator does, whole and entire, from the start to finish, end of quote. A.B. Kane noted that, in quote, man struggles for life and meaning in an environment that taunts him with its paradoxes, birth and death, weeping and laughter, love and hate, war and peace, and the like, end of quote. This relentless and inflexible cycle of events extends beyond the grasp of man's control and understanding. Together, the litany of preceding comments paints a rather dark and unsettling picture. When we candidly and objectively look at the facts, we should not be surprised that at times our life experiences seem very vague, incongruous, and antithetical. And we follow the path we thought right, but still we are ended up in wrong ways. And the result, is totally unexpected. We are left feeling confused, powerless, and frustrated as well. Somewhere along the way, we begin to ask what life is really about, all about. And what is the meaning of life? And why am I living? The preacher was Israel's wisest and most powerful king and wrestled with these issues. And he recorded his observations and conclusions in the book of Ecclesiastes. And his conclusion is simply something like this. Life is full of divine paradoxes. In verses 1 to 8, the first part of the verse is talking about God ordering life's events. As we studied before, the preacher noted that life is really ephemeral, unreliable, and incomprehensible, especially when separated from God. And chapter 1, verses 1 to 11, I think, clearly explains it. So everything is vanity. Likewise, the true meaning and joy come only from God. In chapter 3, the preacher considered the spectrum of life's activities and events and affirmed that all of them, in fact, are under God's sovereign ordering and control. They are seemingly directionless and meaningless, but it is not true because everything is under God's sovereign ordering and control. In other words, though there are many things in life we do not fully understand and comprehend, but the life is not chaotic as we sometimes think. First of all, it says everything has its own purpose. Chapter 3, verse 1 says, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. The parallel sentence structure of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 1, indicates that the Hebrew terms rendered time and season denote a range of human endeavors and situations on earth, all of which are appointed by God to occur at the appropriate moment. While he has ordained a time for everything, the responsibility of the righteous is to seek the Lord's wisdom so that they might discern what activities go with what season and what time. It also indicates that no one lives a meaningless life because everything is fallen into right time and right season, and no purpose is meaningless or vain. Every life is purposeful. It is like a strong counterpunch to the notion that life is simply uncertain and meaningless. Anyone who desires a meaningful life must come to God. And in fact, that is the conclusion he's drawing from this chapter. Because apart from God, life does not make any sense. Everything includes, the word everything includes all activities that takes place under the heaven. We find here from verse 8, we find here 14 pairs of opposites. In Hebrew speech, the mentioning of opposites together express the totality. So, for example, when we are talking about heaven and earth, it stands for all of physical and spiritual reality. Thus, these 14 pairs are meant to be representative of all the activities of life. The preacher rounds out his presentation in Ecclesiastes 3, verses 2 to 8, by addressing what comes between birth and death. So, verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. Verse 2 opens with the observation that God establishes the time for birth and the time for death. In preacher's view, God has planned for our arrivals. We did not arrive into this world because we wanted or we planned. But according to God's appointment, God's divine appointment, we were born into this world. So God has a plan for our arrivals on earth, for the living out of our temporal existence, and likewise he has made an appointment for our departures from life. In the previous two chapters, the preacher commented on the brevity of life. However, he addresses to his readers that everyone is born with a purpose which gives a meaning to life and dignity to every person. In the divine ordering of earthly existence, people take time to plant crops as well as to uproot the same. Planting seeds and pulling weeds must be done to reap a harvest. The same is true of life in general. Some aspects must be planted and others uprooted if life is to be complete and meaningful. And verse 3, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. Man engages in killing and healing activities as well as tearing down and building up initiatives. The preacher addresses creative and destructive endeavors used for either establishing or undermining. When the preacher noted that there is a time to kill, this is a bit hard to understand. And obviously he was not condoning premeditated murder. Two words, kill and heal, are not exact semantic opposites. But a kill refers to an intentional act to end a life, and heal refers to intentional efforts to preserve a life. The preacher here is describing what occurs under the sun, and so I understand it in two ways. Number one, the killing may refer to the legitimate ending of life, at least according to the worldview of the Old Testament, such as capital punishment. It also raises questions to our minds as such, what is the proper time to resist the evil with forcefulness? Or when is it time to negotiate and seek reconciliation? Number two, on the other hand, the killing here reflects the events in life. Isn't it true that there are lots of killings happening in the world? Without adding any moral judgment to them, the preacher simply says about what is happening. And even such unpleasant and unwanted events do not escape from the eyes of God. And also, even such incidents do not frustrate the providence of God. Of course, there are also times when those who seek to revere and obey God need to tear down negative aspects of their personal lives, and times when they need to build up the positive aspects. So the pair of tearing down and building up may refer to construction work, and at the same time, it is possible that the pair talks about warfare. Verse 4, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Verse 4 moves the reader farther along the path of life sovereignly or order the events by mentioning such activities as expressing sorrow and joy, along with mourning and dancing. The preacher covered the range of human emotions, both private and public, in these two lines of the poem. The Hebrew words are translated weep and laugh, indicate expressions of an individual's emotion, more in private according to BDB Hebrew lexicon, while the Hebrew verbs translated mourn and dance indicate expressions of a group emotions. We may say from the verse that there is a time for an individual to be sad and a time for that person to be happy. And likewise, there is a time for an individual to join with others in lamenting a loss and a time for that person to join with others in celebration. Verse 5, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. So in verse 5, the preacher draws attention to throwing away and gathering stones along with embracing and refraining from doing so. Various interpretations exist of these two lines of the poem. So throwing away and gathering stones could mean, like in ancient times, fields taken by enemies were made unproductive by scattering stones across them. It is a deliberate ruining of the enemy's field. Oppositely, stones were gathered from fields as a sign of a community's desire for peace. It is to make the field suitable for agricultural purpose. A different interpretation points to the gathering of stones for use in building a wall to keep out invaders. In contrast, the tearing down those stones indicated that the residents' desire to make a peace with their enemies. Embracing and refraining, it also is attracting various interpretations. According to one view, a time to embrace is a call for people of faith to comfort someone who is experiencing pain, grief, or reconciliation. Yet, at other times, it is best for the upright to respect a person's privacy and not to interfere. So sometimes embrace, sometimes refrain from embracing. A second, more literal view places the preacher's advice in the context of love and its physical expression between a man and a woman. Thus, there is a time to show affection and a time to refrain from doing so. So if you read the commentaries, you may find those various interpretations. Verse 6, a time to get, a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away. It has something to do with our possessions. It reveals that God establishes a time for individuals to search for people and possessions, as well as the moment when the latter should be given up as lost. At least a portion of life on earth consists of humanity's concern for accumulating or getting rid of what they own. God bestowed on people special times when they must look long and hard for things, friendships and goals, and hold on to them when they were acquired. But there are other times when he summons people to give these up. Verse 7, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. The preacher spotlighted the times of ripping things up and sowing them together, as well as keeping silent and deciding to speak. The tearing and mending most likely refer to the ancient custom of rending one's clothes in grief. Tearing clothes was an important biblical mourning ritual. So if you look at different parts of the Old Testament, when people were mourning, they were tearing their own clothes. The clothes would be repaired at the close of the mourning period. The second half of verse 7 reminds the reader that communication, a key part of human existence, is like a two-way street. Thus, there is a time to remain quiet and there is a time to voice one's opinion, an integral, an interval to listen, and an interval to remark. The time of speaking and silence is occasionally connected with a very important wisdom theme of knowing the proper time to speak and to refrain from speaking. And verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. This verse notes that in the divine ordering of earthly matters, there are times for love and hate, along with the seasons for war and peace. The preacher recognized that life on earth can hardly resemble what God intended for it when human affections are missing. Indeed, throughout history, the existence of people has been marked by both love and hatred. The preacher encouraged his readers to be careful about the times when both are exercised. As a king, I think Solomon understood what it means really very clearly. He understood the necessity of taking account of the political endeavors of his audience. For instance, the same emotions that can give rise to love or hatred in two individuals can also give rise to war or peace in two communities. Furthermore, as history has shown, conflicts will always arise. Sometimes wrong is resisted with force, at other times peace is the goal. After all, everything is in the providence of God, and it is wisdom to man who finds and understands it, but he will not be able to know and understand everything all the time. Only the infinite God orders all events in life, and the longing to find all those answers in eternity is within us, but we have limitations to find all the answers. So there is a place of frustration. Then how should we live? If our life just ended up with the frustrations, the despair, and the sense of failures, is there any excitement in life? Well, in verses 9 to 22, God orders man to enjoy despite all of these and end. God orders life's events, and he also exhorts them to enjoy what he has in this life. First of all, there are perplexities in life. In verse 9 to verse 11, verses 9 to 11, would you like to read chapter 3, verses 9 to 11? Verse 9 to 11. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Amen. I wonder what you could learn from this. This is quite a profound passage. It is understandable why people, in their efforts to make a sense of life's enigmas, would ask what advantage or benefit they obtained from their hard work, spend time, all the efforts to live right and work very hard for right things and so on. But it seems that the result is not something that we have expected. Then our natural question is, what is the benefit of doing all those things? The preacher casts doubt over the benefit of a world where everything has its proper season or opportune moment. Probably it is the same reaction some of you want to show too. In times of hardships and tragedies, someone tells us that all things work together for their good. You may resent to such words, and you all know that verse. However, when you are in trials and difficulties and hardships, someone quotes such a verse you know so well, it does not please you at all, because you cannot just match up with that verse with the emotion that you are facing against all those events in life. If God knows all things, and he orders all things, why then this and that has happened in the first place? You kept faith, but what profit did you get out of it? The preacher argues that there may be no purpose to doing anything in this fallen world. Ecclesiastes 3:1-8 leaves us with the impression that there is an unmistakable rhythm and order to existence on earth because God orders life's events. However, it would be incorrect to conclude from this that everything that occurs in the world is straightforward and predictable. An examination of the first two chapters of this book indicates that life experiences are filled with paradoxes and that God oversees the ebb and flow of creation even though it remains opaque and cryptic to human beings. Just you cannot understand what is happening and what is going on. The preacher acknowledged the travail God has placed on the human race in verse 10. Travail renders the Hebrew noun, which can be translated as occupation, task, or job. In the present context, this refers to the efforts of people through theology, philosophy, and science, to name a few disciplines, to determine on a daily basis this and that happenings and events in life fit into the divine ordering of life. However, this search for meaning only ends in frustration, for people constantly discover anew that the whole picture of life on planet Earth truly eludes them. It is almost the same as what chapter 1 verses 13 and 14 say about. In verse 11, he hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Even the sharpest minds remain ignorant of God's providence. Rather than become endlessly preoccupied with trying to discern the letter, the preacher affirmed that. So in other words, he says, even though things are not making any sense to you at this moment of time, your life experiences seem to be senseless. However, the preacher affirmed that God has beautifully orchestrated everything to occur at precisely the right moment. Just like that. The preacher also acknowledged that God has set the world, eternity, in the human heart. Expressed differently, the Creator has made people with a deep-seated, inborn awareness of God's ways in the world that transcends the present and impels them to comprehend how the past, the present, and future all fit together. If we truly understand that every moment, every experience is quite meaningful, the reason that you are here at this moment of time, I'm here at this moment of time, I'm sharing this message with you, and you are listening, everything becomes a part of divine orders, divine plan. T. Kruger thinks the Hebrew noun eternity, rendered as eternity, denotes a, in quote, concept or idea of distant time that extends far beyond the life of an individual human being in the direction of either the past or the future or both, end of quote. Man is made to long for eternity. That is our capacity. That is why man experiences only brokenness if their minds dwell only on the things of this world. These material things that have limits within themselves cannot satisfy the souls of man that have the capacity of embracing the concept or idea of eternity, longing for eternity. Despite each generation's stellar intellectual abilities and attainments, people remain largely ignorant of what God has foreordained. They are even unable to fathom the nature and timing of events during the course of their individual lives. And incredibly, no one is, in quote, privy to the designs of this inscrutable God and cannot predict the consequences of human works, end of quote. Science is destined to fail to offer any meaning or purpose of life. Science is able to argue what reality is from as many realms and ideas as it chooses. But this hypothesizing is based on a limited understanding of how the cosmos was formed. All other worldviews but God-centered, the theistic worldview, are self-defeating and inadequate in making sense of existence, both physical and metaphysical. Without God, all human efforts are unable to answer questions surrounding humanity's journey of life and their final destination, life after death. Science should not be against religion. They are separate, but at the same time, they are complementary disciplines from man's point of view. And man is only a man. According to Ecclesiastes 3:11, since God's ways are inscrutable, human beings are powerless to make anything different, at least permanently. So W.S. Towner explains that this state of affairs is, in quote, deterministic but not fatalistic, end of quote, because it is something like, if God has ordered everything, then there is nothing for us to do. Then it will make us fatalists. There is nothing for us to do. But what he argues for is that, no, that is not true. All these things are deterministic by God, but it will not make us fatalists. For people are still perfectly free and responsible to act. Probably this is the difference between Christianity, believing in God's sovereign will and sovereignty, and some other religions believing in God, but making human life very much determined for their fates. Thus, it doesn't matter really whatever they do. It's like human beings are like robots, programmed robots. The preacher characterizes God as being both a transcendent and immanent in the world, which he created and oversees. So E.P. Lee points out that in the drama of life, God is undisputed the primary act and the one who gives and authorizes. Moreover, the human agent is given a responsibility for the proper use of the right of disposer. So God fulfills his will, but at the same time, God uses agents or means, and those agents and means could be us, we ourselves, and our decisions and our activities. So we are a part of this all God's providence. There are indeed appropriate times for everything, and God does know these times. But speaking of humans, no one can discover what God is doing. Such knowledge is inscrutable. Accordingly, rather than become frustrated and disillusioned, people of faith choose to revere and obey God, trusting that his wisdom is infinite and his eternal purposes are wise. God's presence at every turn signifies a righting of the situation. God is creator, sovereign, and unsearchable wisdom. This mindset is reflected in verse 12, where the preacher advised his readers to enjoy life in the present. You cannot fully comprehend God's will and God's providential work. And at the same time, what you are experiencing in this life may not really make any sense. And what is the proper life for you to have in this world? Well, one is obviously to trust in his providential work and his wisdom. And verse 12, he says that we ought to enjoy life in the present. So verse 12, I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Based on his observations and personal experience, he concluded that the most worthwhile approach is for people to find joy in their God-given existence at this present moment of time. Joy comes while they are doing good, in verse 12, as long as they live. Lee suggests that enjoyment is not only a matter of right conduct As well, it is a matter of character and disposition. Be thankful, as I shared a couple of weeks ago, and enjoy the things that God has given you. One of the things that I have been able to observe from people's life is that some people are constructing their life over or based on their past life. So they are talking about unhappy childhood, some of the abuses they experienced in their earlier years, and so on. So based on that, they are building up their own present life and future life. As a result, they will never be able to enjoy the things that God has given to them right at this present moment, and they cannot build up a better life for the future. They are always dwelling on the future, of the past. So if you are deeply engaged with them in any sort of conversations, eventually they will lead you back to the past. And as a result, they will never be able to enjoy their life. They are simply miserable in the past. And the past miserable life makes them presently very much miserable. And eventually in their future, they will be also miserable. But that is not the way that we are to live. Even though we do not comprehend and we cannot understand a lot of things and so on, but God knows all things, and everything has a purpose, and there is a meaning for everything. While deriving enjoyment in life could include the satisfaction that comes from being charitable and philanthropic in our undertakings, this does not rule out the idea of obtaining pleasure from daily, ordinary experiences. Indeed, the preacher noted that a great source of contentment can be found in eating and drinking and performing satisfying work in verse 13. Verse 13 says, "And also that every man should eat and drink, enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God." How can we find real delight in the common outlets of life? We ought to do so by believing that such daily activity, indeed all of life itself, is a gift of God. The reason that we are even able to think about these things is because God has given us a gift to be able to think, to make us think. This is only possible when people humbly revere the Lord and place their confidence in Him. So J.E. Smith maintains that Ecclesiastes 3, 12 and 13 is not advocating licentiousness simply by saying eating and drinking and enjoying. Instead, the preacher is enjoining, in quote, that happy appreciation of the innocent pleasures which the love of God offers to those who live in accordance with His standards of goodness, end of quote. Ginsburg and Fox explain that while God-given enjoyments are, in quote, brief, imperfect, and uncertain, they are enough to make life worth living, end of quote. Enjoy what you have, whether it is a person, a possession, an opportunity, or a time in remembrance of the Lord, the giver. God has given you those things. Only God, what God does is forever. He endures forever. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it, then men should fear before Him. People are unable to change His sovereign plans. God has designed the world to operate in this way, so that people should fear before Him. This fear is not an irrational feeling of dread and impending doom. It is more than courteous reverence. Fearing the Lord is a multivalent concept. It includes an affirmation of His sovereignty and power. It involves revering Him in worship and obeying Him unconditionally. And it encompasses a reverent recognition of the perfection of God's work, as Kruger said. And everything is before God. Nothing is hidden from Him. Nothing can escape from His eyes. So whatever trials, whatever challenging situations you are facing, Everything is before God. That is a great encouragement and comfort. Verse 15, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. The preacher takes a broader view of history, especially as it affects people. Throughout the course of human affairs, people seek to discern God's will. As they try to make a sense of his providential undertaking, they begin to discover that history is more than just the facts and events repeating themselves without meaning. Admittedly, incidents tend to occur in certain patterns over and over again. Nevertheless, whatever is happening now or will take place in the future has already occurred before. Nothing is new. Such observations, notwithstanding, the upright with faith in God's wisdom can learn from the course of human events in ways that will benefit them in the present. And I think one of the ways that we can learn from these things is to learn history. And so church history does give us benefit. And this coming Wednesday, we're going to resume our studies on church history. The precise meaning of the latter part of verse 15 is debated. It's hard. The idea is that God seeks to do again what occurred in prior generations. It could also mean that one day God will call the past into account. This statement can be both unsettling and reassuring. It is sobering to realize that people must answer to God for whatever they have done throughout their time on earth. The reality of this truth is stressed in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 to 5. So all of our life accounts will be told, will be reported, testified before the presence of God. And all the time, at the same time, it is comforting to remember that God will vindicate the righteous. In particular, he will not overlook those who have suffered evil at the hands of others, especially believers and innocent people who have been persecuted and slaughtered. And every one of those events will not be forgotten by God, but everything will be remembered. And yes, everything will be thus fair. So here is a beauty to believe in God. When we see the injustice and the presence of evil in the world, we are blaming God. But in fact, if you take God out of this injustice and unjust world, in fact, you and I do not have any hope. If you remove God from you and from your mind, your thoughts, and you observe all the unjust unfair things in this world, and it seems that the evil ones are more prosperous than the righteous ones, and it seems that more faithful ones are having more sufferings than other people, and so on. Where can you find justice without God? Everything has purpose and meaning, and because there is God, there is a meaning in life. It is because everything will be fair. Ecclesiastes 3:16-22 explores further the theme of divine justice in the midst of human oppression. The preacher doubts the very concept of justice in verse 16 by saying, "And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there." So there is wicked people, there is righteous people, and also at the same time, it seems that there is no difference. Iniquity was there. The word judgment denotes what is upright or fair in a moral and legal sense. The question is, why does God allow evil in the world, and where is justice? The preacher answers to his own question in verses 17 and 18 by saying, "I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts." The preacher does not speculate about what kind of punishment the wicked will receive, but he says that there will be divine judgment and vindication. The execution of it is in the hands of God. He reserves a time of judgment in his own wisdom. The point is that in the end, God's justice will triumph. Man cannot exceed the parameters of his existence. He is as mortal as animals. He breathes and dies. In verses 19 and 20, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, animals. Even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Therefore, everything in life seems to be fleeting and fruitless. And after all, both humans and animals are ended up in the graves. Therefore, make the most of your opportunity to live for God. If we take God out of us, what is the difference between us and the beasts? That is preacher's observation. Life is short and filled with injustice. Therefore, it is best for us to find the satisfaction in our work that God has given to us. Ultimately, whatever joy we obtain from our labor is our God-given reward. And so whatever God has given you, whatever blessings God has given you, and whatever opportunities he has given you, enjoy it. Take a pleasure out of it. If there will be justice and judgment to all, isn't it wise for us to live for God? Because everything will be fair. Fearing God means to be conscious of his limitless and unfathomable power and to be aware of the uncertainty and brevity of life. Xiao explains that those who fear God recognize the, in quote, chasm between the divine and the human, end of quote. Also, they know the proper place of humanity in relation to deity. Moreover, they embrace life as God providentially gives it, including the confusing and incomprehensible events in life. What is life really all about? From the vantage point of eternity, our life seems utterly meaningless, especially when separated from God. We also find out that our efforts to look beyond the present, especially to understand the past and probe into future, are thwarted by God himself. So in other words, man does not have ultimate answers for his own questions. Because we are creatures of time and not allowed to know the eternal plan of God, we are confused and perplexed at times. The preacher says that there is one who knows and orders all things, and he is also in control over all things. It also means that life is beyond our own self-control. The best way to cope the ebbs of serious events in life is to know and understand that every moment is given by God. Therefore, do not waste every moment and every opportunity, but acknowledge him and take it as a gift from God. Do very best with what God has given us and enjoy every single moment with what God has allowed us to have. Everything has its own purpose and its own time ordered by God. And I think Apostle Paul knew about it. And so that's why 2 Timothy chapter 1 verse 12, the second half of the verse, he says, but I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. The divine paradoxes we experience in life must lead us to God for hope and strength. And I'm sure that there is no exception amongst us that, without any exception, every one of us has experienced or experiencing such paradoxes in life. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. Divine paradoxes lead us to God, because we do recognize that answers are not within us. And these thoughts are encouraging and exhorting us to come to Him by faith. Thus, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. Amen. Let us look to the Lord in prayer. Father in heaven, many a time we face events and moments in life that make us truly frustrated. And a lot of things do not make any sense to us. We have done everything which we have thought right, but still the end result is not something that as we have hoped for. Sometimes the things are happening against our expectations, and sometimes we are wondering where is our divine God and the justice of God. Dear Lord, we do confess this morning that we do not comprehend everything in life. We are perplexed, we are frustrated. Sometimes at night, when no one is around us, we cannot but cry. Dear gracious Lord, in this divine paradoxes, help us to know You better and trust You and have confidence in You and believe in You. Do not trust in our own self-wisdom, but cast all our burdens unto You. Dear gracious Lord, the more we feel that life is full of fogs, the more we'll come to You by trusting in You and confidence in You. Lord, increase our faith. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.